This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Big sleep makes big money. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Americans are not sleeping well, and an entire industry is cashing in. Hear what we're paying to help us find better shut-eye.
Lessons from a coffee chain. When is it acceptable to kick somebody out of your store?
The nation has found itself divided over another issue, Hawaiian pizza. Do pineapples go with tomato and cheese?
And the new trend in political campaign ads, showing the candidate behind the wheel.
The sort of goal of the is to sort of show them as sort of a regular person doing the sort of thing that everybody does, and whether that, you know, driving on a freeway or sitting in traffic or ferrying kids to school, a way to show politicians in an everyday light in a world where it's increasingly difficult to do so.
Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein on the latest in campaign ads. He's here later in the hour. Well, moments after that terrible Valentine's Day, the thought crept into the minds of the yearbook staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. They would have to memorialize this tragedy in their pages somehow. At the school in Parkland, Florida, where a former student is accused of killing 17 people in a deadly rampage, editors decided the shooting would not overtake their book. They insisted on preserving a record of the days that came before, the ones filled with the regular markers of high school life, football games, club activities, right? The Sadie Hawkins dance. Here's how they did it from Patricia Mazzei, Miami bureau chief at the New York Times. Patricia, what did you do?
We took some time with the yearbook staff to just figure out how you put this tragedy in a book. And they realized right away they were going to have to honor the dead and make sure that they could sort of memorialize what happened, you know, without sensationalizing it. They were very careful about that. And so they wanted to give each of the victims a page to honor their lives and remember the vigils that everybody went through and the tattoos that students got to remember the day. So it was really a thought process of we want to give people a chance to remember the people who died and the extraordinary days that followed because they were such an important part of the school year. Mm.
Not including what happened was not an option, I presume?
It wasn't. They were close to their deadline, but they still had several weeks to go. And they figured, while they didn't want this their whole yearbook to be about this, because they wanted to remember the good times in the school year as well, it was just too big to ignore.
Mm. So I think you pointed out the publisher kind of extended the deadline for them?
Yes, they were very flexible with them, and donations started to pour in even though they didn't ask for them. There was a yearbook advisor in Texas who did not know anybody at Stoneman Douglas but figured they would need some help. She started a GoFundMe, and those funds went to benefit the yearbook and the school newspaper. And so they just got to work with making a bigger, you know, adding pages. At making a bigger yearbook and taking time to find the photos and the people to talk about each of the victims.
Wow. So is the yearbook much larger than a typical one for that school?
Yes. They added 17 spreads in total. Those are, you know, two-page spreads because you can't just add one page at a time. You know, when a book is bound, you need to have both sides of the pages. And they're also printing many more books than they usually do because they just expect a higher demand from the school community. This is not something that is just available for anybody to buy, but just from within the student body and the families and the teachers, they expect a much higher demand.
Was there an overall theme that they developed or stuck with, say, before the shooting?
Interestingly, last year when they decided on their theme for this school year, it was going to be As One. And it certainly got new poignancy after the shooting when they realized, well, everybody came together, not just within the school, but the South Florida community, Parkland, the solidarity they got from high schools across the state and across the country. They were getting boxes of mail from people just wanting to send cards and condolences and prayers and thoughts and positive thoughts to the students. I mean, they would show up in the mailroom in the morning and the teachers would, they wouldn't even know what to do with so much outpouring of support.
Wow.
So that theme of as one really crystallized after the shooting.
How about that? Well, we're speaking with Patricia Mazet, Miami Bureau Chief at the New York Times. She's written a piece about the yearbook that the students at Stoneman Douglas High School have to put out this year following the shooting back on Valentine's Day. Did the editors or staff find themselves debating particular points about how to capture what happened?
They were very concerned about not triggering students to sort of relive their trauma. So they did not want photographs of students sobbing at a vigil, for example.
Okay.
They wanted the art to be a little bit more artistic, composed, a little bit less, they said less of a newspaper and more of a yearbook, because they just didn't feel the need to make it seem like a tabloid, essentially.
Yeah.
They really wanted it to be something everyone would be comfortable sharing. They didn't want the headlines to be too sappy, you know, the titles of their pages, but it was emotional, so they were sort of struggling with what that line was going to be in their writing, you know, and in their captions. They were really very painstaking about what words they were and were not going to use. It was interesting to see.
Speaking of that, I know you mentioned as one was the theme, but what was the phrase "forever loved" that they came up with? What was that for?
They were coming up with a title for the vigils, the spreads of all of the memorials that there were after the shooting, and then they had one for the tattoos because so many students got tattoos to remember the dead, and that's where they were kind of going back and forth, like, forever loved, is this too sappy for a vigil?
Okay.
For the tattoos, do we, you know, we want to make reference to the fact that the ink on the skin lasts forever, or can last forever, and that people are really going to carry this for the rest of their lives. And so, you know, we were just hanging out there in the yearbook office and hearing these sort of debates go back and forth in the middle of regular teenage drama, you know, of who had cut their hair and playing a thumb war and who was getting food because they were getting hungry.
Thanks, Patricia. That's New York Times Miami Bureau Chief Patricia Mazet. It's 14 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Look into any great business, whether it's a manufacturer or a hotel, a store, school, or hospital. Look into each and every one of them, and you'll find the same thing. Great people. At Kronos, we believe that great businesses are powered by great people. And with Kronos Workforce Solutions, we'll help you find them, keep them, and engage them. Learn more at Kronos.com. Kronos. Workforce innovation that works.
Thanks for being with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. Under what circumstances can a clerk or other employee order a person to leave a store? The question has come up amid this national uproar stemming from the videotaped arrest of two black men at a Starbucks in Philadelphia. The men were denied use of a restroom because they didn't order food or drinks. The store manager called police when they refused to leave. They explained they were waiting for a friend. As video rolled, the friend arrived as police led the pair away in handcuffs. They were later released when Starbucks did not press charges. In the video, they're neatly groomed, wearing casual clothes, and not causing a ruckus. More on the legalities from Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. Charisse, what have you found?
You know, you can have a policy that sets guidelines for what's unacceptable behavior, and certainly if somebody is being extremely noticeably disruptive, you certainly can ask them to leave the premises or even call the police if you have to. But you need to be consistent with that policy, applying it equally to all patrons, and certainly using race or religion or ethnic origin are never acceptable reasons to have somebody leave your establishment.
Mm. Hard to believe we still need to review that in 2018.
Yeah.
Disruptive, though, I guess, is objective also.
I mean, it can be. I mean, I think there's certain things that are obvious. If somebody's in a restaurant and they begin to scream,
yeah,
or they're hurling insults at someone, I mean, there's some things that are just very, very obvious. And that's the reason why beyond those obvious examples, you need a policy that says, okay, in this particular establishment, we have a dress code. And so if you come in and you're wearing flip-flops and we have a sign up that says no flip-flops, that's a problem. We can ask you to leave. So you have to very much have those guidelines in place, and then really apply them uniformly and make sure your managers understand them and articulate them to the people that they're addressing.
Do you have to keep written rules nearby, perhaps to show somebody?
That's very helpful, yeah, to definitely have it so that the customer knows what the rules are, and so managers know. I mean, they need to be trained to begin with, but it's good to have those reminders so that if something does happen and they're a little bit squirrely and not sure how to respond, they can kind of check with that and see, okay, this is an instance where I definitely need to ask this person to leave. This is an instance where this person has a right to stay.
So when you get to the point where you are going to ask someone to leave because you feel that there have been violations, what's that approach?
You know, it's always good to approach a person, you know, with kindness and respect. And again, that's where it's helpful to have the rules right there outlined so they can point to them and say, you know, this is the problem that we're having. Sir or ma'am, would you please, you know, leave the premises? If they still won't leave at that point, then you might want to go ahead and call the police. But that's a scenario that gets very extreme. It can go left. It can be, you know, something that turns injurious, and so you don't want to have to take that step if you don't have to. But ultimately, that is a last resort if the person is violating a clearly defined policy and will not leave the premises.
Yeah. Well, how much of that falls to a manager?
You know, the manager should know, you know, what the rules are. And often security professionals, even if they're on site, they don't want to be the first point of a confrontation with a customer. They feel it's better if the manager does come out,
yeah,
and kind of takes that lead. And then if they still have a problem, then security can get involved. But they really prefer it to be something that becomes an issue between the customer and the staff to kind of keep it on a certain playing field, to not escalate it too quickly.
We're speaking with Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. She's written a piece entitled, Starbucks Did It, Is It Okay to Kick You Out of a Store? What are the lawyers saying here? These two guys involved in this incident in Starbucks, might they have a lawsuit? You know, is there a lawsuit worthiness, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear if the two gentlemen are actually going to file anything, but there are lawyers who feel that they would have a good case. And part of it is, you know, when you have something like this happens, you need as much evidence as possible, right? The onus is on the plaintiff, the person who brings the legal complaint, to prove that this incident happened and it was biased. And so it's helpful if there are emails or if there are videotapes, as there are in this case, or if you have other witnesses who can point to what's called disparate treatment. So you have several patrons at this particular Starbucks who happen to be white who have said, I've sat there and I haven't ordered anything and I've been able to use the restroom, I've been able to stay as long as I wanted and nobody asked me to leave or called the cops. And so the difference between these two men and those patrons is very clear because they look very different. They have different ethnicities. And so that is something that, in a lawsuit, a judge might consider, and it might go in their direction in terms of victory. But the more evidence you have, the better, because, again, the onus is on the person that brings the complaint.
Thanks, Charisse. Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Few dishes have drawn such universal ire or impassioned defense as Hawaiian pizza. The polarizing pizza that sliced apart family and friends for years is now a global symbol of questionable taste. Political leaders, celebrities, and would-be lovers are judged on the answer to one question, according to the Wall Street Journal. Does pineapple belong on pizza? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Hawaiian pizza, yes or no? Kelsey G. of the Wall Street Journal has researched this debate and has more on what's stoking the fierce opinions on both sides. Kelsey, why is Hawaiian pizza so divisive?
So that's exactly the question that I wondered as a Hawaiian pizza lover when I first pitched the idea a few months ago, because I kept encountering people who had very, very strong anti-opinions, like not just, no, my preference is sausage, like pineapple on pizza is an abomination, and, you know, people who eat it have terrible taste. And I think what it comes down to is really, it's an easy thing to fight about. You know, it's not like immigration policy or like gun control laws. You know, people can disagree about whether or not to order pineapple on their pizza and still get along with one another. And I think that's really cathartic for people in a moment where we do seem to be fighting about a lot of stuff.
Kelsey, let's talk about the origination. Is it really from Hawaii?
No, it is not from Hawaii. And in fact, the Hawaiians that I talked to had very, very funny opinions about what they prefer to pineapple. It's from Canada, actually. There's a Greek immigrant who opened a Chinese restaurant in the 1960s. And because he was serving, you know, his interpretation of Chinese food at the time, he had a bunch of canned pineapple on the shelf and like available to be used. So one day when he decided to, you know, add some things to the menu and was thinking pizza, he just threw some pineapple on it. And I think he had some ham as well around, and it took off.
So, Kelsey, is Hawaiian pizza eaten all over the world, not just the U.S.?
It is. That's the other thing about this debate, which is so funny. It's kind of universally detested and universally defended. I talked to Domino's, which is one of the world's largest pizza chains. They have restaurants in like 85 countries and territories or something crazy like that. And in almost every single one of those countries, they serve pineapple as an ingredient on these pizzas.
We're speaking with Kelsey G of the Wall Street Journal. Kelsey, why are celebrities and politicians even weighing in on this?
So it's become a bit of a meme. Hawaiian pizza, over the course of the past couple of years, has become this like pop cultural symbol of questionable taste. I would prefer not to think of it as bad taste, but definitely raises some questions about how people enjoy their food. And so, you know, it's just become a funny internet thing to ask anyone of significance, do you like pineapple on your pizza? What is your position on the big issue about Hawaiian pizza?
That's a yes. This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Kelsey G. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
If you want the absolute best shirts around, you have to go to CT Shirts. I want you to try them because once you do, you'll never go back to some random shirt off the shelf of a department store. And CT Shirts come in custom sizes, so you're not messing with ill-fitted sleeve lengths or neck sizes. It's time to step up your game and look your best, so I got you a special CT Shirts deal. 3 CT Shirts for $99. CT Shirts use the softest, most exquisite fabrics ever. Work or casual, tie or no tie, tuck or untucked, when you're wearing a CT shirt, you'll look your best. Here's the deal. 1 CT shirt normally costs $100, but right now you get 3 shirts for just $99. That's 60% off. Go to ctshirts.com/deal. And CT shirts come with free delivery, a 6-month quality guarantee, and free returns. If you hurry, $99 gets you 3 amazing CT shirts. ctshirts.com/deal. That's ctshirts.com/deal.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. Distracted driving deaths are on the rise. Hear what's being done about it. Also, the newest trend in political TV ads. And Twitter users respond to the hashtag, I'd like to be rich enough to. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. We're thinking differently about the importance of sleep these days. The awareness is a good thing. However, sometimes thinking about it too much can lead to sleeplessness. In the meantime, it's turned into a massive business opportunity, even for already famously rich and successful quarterbacks. More from Beth Tytel, reporter at the Boston Globe. Beth, what have you found?
Well, I was just so struck by how much people are doing to actually try to fall asleep. I mean, they're wearing, you know, there's just so many things. First of all, the nation is obese, aging, and has insomnia. Somebody wrote in and said we should be called Sleep Apnea Nation. You know, thinking about, you know, with our restless legs twitching and the sleep apnea mask delivering this steady air pressure and sleep trackers or monitoring our wakefulness and blackout shades are darkening the room. There's Neiman Marcus sells a $29 deep sleep pillow spray. I'm not even sure what it does. People have white noise machines going. Yeah. There's meditation gurus who are intoning mantras on downloaded apps. People are slathering their body with cannabis oils. They're sleeping under 25-pound weighted blankets trying to calm their anxiety.
My goodness.
So it's just, I was so struck, and it's turned sleep into a $30 to $40 billion industry, according to a 2017 report from McKinsey.
Holy cow. Does that, some people must admit, though, that that actually itself adds to the stress, no?
No, totally. You mean the fact that you're not sleeping adds to the stress, and
yeah,
that you're spending all this money on it.
Yeah, just thinking, yeah, like, come on, 25-pound blanket, make me fall asleep sooner.
Totally. I mean, it was interesting. It's interesting because sleep's reputation has changed. I mean, sleep was once for losers who couldn't cut it in the hard-charging business world. I mean, you have all these people saying, oh, I only sleep 4 hours a night. But now it's like sleep is the new MBA. But it would be actually a mistake to see sleep's new status as a sign that society has recognized the need to slow down. It's the opposite. Sleep is actually popular now because we now know that a rested employee is a better employee.
Is that thanks to, like, CDC warnings about the dangers of lack of sleep?
Oh, totally. Yeah, there's so many problems. I mean, it actually is kind of scary. There's just, I mean, people, you can lead to all types of chronic diseases and conditions, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity, depression. But actually, as you were pointing out, mental distress can also come from wasting money on sleep aids that don't work.
Yeah.
And Consumer Reports recently cautioned readers in 2016 about an industry that was just basically waiting for its moment, sleep coaching.
Okay.
Sleep coaches charge up to $150 an hour, and they analyze diet and bedroom environment. But as a spokeswoman for the Academy of Sleep Medicine told Consumer Reports, there's little evidence that people who hire these coaches actually sleep better.
Wow. Hey, but maybe that's just a psychological effect, you know, and if it works, well, better for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Also, I'm kind of interested in how sort of really big names, and you can tell that it's really trending because major tastemakers are eager to co-brand. Tom Brady has $200 sleep-enhancing pajamas. Arietta Huffington has written a book on the subject. Gwyneth Paltrow is pushing a clean sleeping regimen. Actually, those three, by the way, along with the Dalai Lama, were named to Tomorrow Magazine's prestigious list of 2018's 10 most influential people in sleep. I love that there's a list, the 10 most influential people in sleep.
You've got to be kidding me. All right, so since you're from the Boston Globe, you got to help me out with this Tom Brady angle here. $200 better sleep pajamas?
Yeah, I guess they're supposed to help you recover and sleep better. I mean, obviously something's working for him.
Not true.
I feel like that by when Uggs introduces a $500 slumber booty, sleep's makeover will be complete.
We're speaking with Beth Tytel, reporter at the Boston Globe. She's written a piece about the big money in getting a good night's sleep. What are the basics, by the way? What do these like sleep professionals say besides turn off
the
electronics?
There aren't that many tricks. Like limit caffeine late in the afternoon. You know, limit caffeine after 1 or noon. Only use your bed for sleeping. You know, don't like conduct, you know, don't be hanging out in your bed for hours ahead of time reading, doing all sorts of things. But the bed should be when you're asleep. People say, like, don't turn on electronics. So if you wake up in the middle of the night, it's not a good idea to all of a sudden look at your cell phone or anything like that. There aren't that many things. I mean, you know, don't drink too much alcohol. Basic stuff. Unfortunately, there's no magic. I mean, there's pills, but obviously those have a downside. So.
Thanks, Beth. Beth Tytel, reporter at the Boston Globe. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. There were more than 34,000 fatal motor vehicle crashes in the United States in 2016. Too many of those were attributed to things like texting, phone calls, or fiddling with the radio. With the increased usage of cell phones and advancements in smartphone technology, drivers are becoming even more distracted, leading to a steady increase in accidents and fatalities. Aside from these dangers, accidents lead to more expensive auto insurance premiums for everyone. More from Julie Mix McPeak, president of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and the state insurance commissioner in Tennessee. Julie, give us some numbers.
Yes, well, distracted driving is a serious public safety concern. We know that 1 in 10 fatal auto accidents involve at least one driver being distracted behind the wheel. And that's so tragic because those accidents could be avoided.
What kind of various distractions are we talking about, by the way, when we discuss this?
You know, not only interaction with our smartphones, but also with the technology on our cars themselves, like navigational tools, but also, you know, standard distractions that we've had for many years, including applying makeup, tying a tie, trying to eat while you are driving, anything that takes your eyes off of the road and away from the task at hand of getting safely to your destination.
The I guess coupled with the distractions are these various improved safety technologies, right, that are coming to cars, like avoidance collision, lane departure, things like that. Have both of those things in some way impacted insurance rates one way or the other?
You know, those things have helped in terms of adding safety to the vehicles themselves, but it also adds cost to the repairs when accidents occur because that technology is expensive, and a lot of times that includes cameras in the rear bumpers and things that happen when you have a fender bender type accident. And so, you know, the frequency and the severity of auto accidents have really been increasing since 2010, and that's reflected in auto insurance premiums.
Well, we're speaking with Julie Mix McPeak. She's president of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. She is also the Tennessee Insurance Commissioner. We're talking about the jump in distracted driving deaths. What can be done to counteract this?
You know, we really just need to remain focused on being a safe driver with all of your attention on the road behind the wheel. And a lot of that is leading by example, putting your phone down when you're in the car so that you are a good example to your passengers and your children. Also being aware of other drivers on the road. If you see someone that is distracted or not paying attention, just be aware that person could swerve into your lane or disregard a traffic signal or a stop sign and anticipate that you might have an issue with other drivers on the road as well.
How much of that is on us as parents, by the way? All of it?
You know, I think a lot of it is because we really need to enforce these rules ourselves. It's extremely difficult for law enforcement to be watching for all of the things that are under their responsibility and also checking to make sure we don't have drivers that are eating or taking video or sending text. It's a lot to ask. So I think we can make the greatest strides when we can enforce these rules ourselves.
Thanks, Julie. That is Julie Mix McPeak, president of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. She holds the similar title in Tennessee. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending time with us. Trending in campaign ads on TV these days, politicians behind the wheel. Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein says there are more than 40 incumbents and challengers who gab and grip the wheel in campaign ads currently, enough drivers to field a lineup for the Indianapolis 500. And he says with 7 months until the election day, the candidate traffic jam can only get worse. Reed, explain.
We're about to sort of get into campaign ad season. A lot of these people running for not just for Congress, but for state offices like governor, attorney general, even mayors, are filming their sort of gauzy political introduction ads. A lot of them are sort of intended for donors or sometimes for constituents to sort of get to know a candidate. And a lot of these ads show candidates in their cars driving someplace in the district or state where they're aimed to represent, trying to connect them with their constituents. The sort of goal of these is to sort of show them as sort of a regular person doing the sort of thing that everybody does, and whether that's, you know, driving on a freeway or sitting in traffic or ferrying kids to school, a way to show politicians in an everyday light in a world where it's increasingly difficult to do so, and particularly for incumbents and people who are already in office, you know, those guys are never behind the wheel of their own car. They're always being driven by either a staff or, if they're statewide elected officials, sometimes by state troopers. And so it's pursuing something of a fiction that, you know, the politicians are just like us.
Geez, was there one advisor for all these dozens of candidates? Or, like, how did this idea become so popular of putting a candidate behind the wheel?
This trend goes back at least to 1994. Fred Thompson, the late Fred Thompson, when he was running, was an actor who was running for the Senate from Tennessee, despite being a Washington lobbyist at the time, drove around Tennessee in a red pickup truck to try to show that he was a regular guy. But it really picked up a lot of steam after 2010, when Scott Brown won a special election to become senator from Massachusetts. He had sort of made a name for himself in the state by driving his pickup truck around to all of his events and featured it pretty heavily in his advertising. And after that, we saw a lot of politicians sort of in
a lot of them in pickup trucks, a lot of them using the same language, in fact, that Scott Brown used in his campaign.
Like what?
Where he introduced his ads by saying, "I'm Scott Brown and this is my truck."
Oh.
And that election was in January of 2010. By that November, there were a half dozen candidates who introduced themselves by saying, "Hi, this is my name. Hi, I'm this is my name, and this is my truck or
really?
This is my car." And so it shows, you know, if something people think something works, it'll get used all over and over again. And you know, certainly it is true. One consultant who's made some of these ads told me that, you know, voters in Omaha aren't necessarily seeing the same ads as voters in Florida.
Yeah.
And so they don't know that it's sort of the same sort of cookie cutter idea being used all across the country.
Thanks, Reed. Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein. It is 7 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. And you can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username @GordonDeal. One day after taxes were due, Twitter users began thinking about their financial situation and what they would like to do if they were only rich enough. On Wednesday, the hashtag I'd like to be rich enough to began trending on Twitter. Tweets poured in with people sharing what they would like to do if they could afford it. One tweet read, hashtag I'd like to be rich enough to eat in restaurants every single day. That's all I'm looking for. Another person wished he could travel the world. Another, pay off my student loans. There was also a giving theme to this. One said, leave huge tips for waitresses and make their day. Hashtag, I'd like to be rich enough to pay my parents back for all that they've done for me over the years. One woman wrote, buy an unused, derelict mansion or big building and convert it into rooms for homeless people. Some funny ones. Hashtag, I'd like to be rich enough to be Batman. I wouldn't fight crime, just wear the suit and grapple up random buildings. Another guy said, not think of a McDonald's value meal as splurging. Celebrities checked in too, but nobody cares what celebrities say. If you want to do the search, the hashtag is, I'd like to be rich enough to. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.